This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast. My name is Michael O'Neill. I'm here in sunny, I almost said Boulder, Colorado. I'm here in sunny Long Beach, California, joined
I'm
by my good
Boulder,
buddy.
Colorado.
Joined by my good buddy, Mr. Scott Fliegelman, there in Boulder, Colorado. Hello there, Scott. How you doing, bud?
Good morning, Michael. A rare morning recording.
Yeah, we're not completely whipped at the end of the day. Today, we're going to talk about five pickleball myths that we've sort of been trained up and taught over the last, you know, few years or however long you've been playing pickleball. And we're here to dispel them. First and foremost, though, a quick little bit of housekeeping. We are very close, guys, to 50,000 downloads for our little podcast. Scott, what do you think about that?
That's pretty amazing.
I think so, too.
Yeah, way to go us.
Yeah, good
and
us.
Our listeners.
Go for us. And also, part of that is that you guys have been really great about sharing the podcast on your social media. That's literally the number one thing you can do for us if you're in any Facebook groups or on Instagram or whatever. The URL to share is 402p.com/Apple. That will take them directly to the Apple podcasts, or 402p.com/Spotify, and that will take them right to our Spotify link. You can also leave a rating and review on that same link, 402p.com/Apple. And that makes a huge difference for us in terms of ranking on the Apple Podcasts app. So that's all great. And finally, if you are looking for a carbon paddle, a CRBN paddle, you can get 10% off using the promo code 402p. All right, let's talk about some pickleball myths here today. There's a bunch that we came up with, but we whittled them down to five. And number one is forehands in the middle. You know, I do feel like I've been part of this, but I think there's maybe a nomenclature thing, Scott, where that person who's on the left-hand side of the court probably has a better forehand than their partner has a better backhand. And this is regarding, to me, the third. This is the third shot, whether it's a drive, a drop, or a lob, but probably a drive or a drop. This one has more accuracy and is a higher percentage shot. So I think maybe there's a bit of a semantics conversation we need to have here. Is that accurate?
We've talked on the show before that at the 4.0 to Pro level, we're not getting stuck hitting our third with our less preferred wing. Pros hit their thirds with their preferred wing. So we've talked about how likely our forehands are better. And in a right-handed world, we're going to hug the far left of our box so that either one of us can get a forehand.
Right. So if you're on the deuce side, if you will, the right side serving to the left, you're right there on the tee, basically. And if you serve and it's behind you on return, then your partner's getting that forehand. And if it's in front of you, you're getting that forehand in general. That's sort of what we were thinking, right?
Yes. So that, you know, we're splitting hairs a little bit. Either way, it's going to be a forehand, but it doesn't necessarily declare which one of us is going to take the forehand.
Right. Versus the person who's on the ad side, the left side, really digging in. I think maybe where the confusion comes from is if the people are serving from, let's say, the middle of the service box, or that person on the right side is serving, you know, they're on the right side. So they're maybe looking for a more angled serve, but that leaves the entire middle of the court open, which is generally where we say your opponent should be returning to. They should be high, deep, and down the middle. So we know a ball's probably coming there. What can we do as the servers to mitigate having to hit a third shot backhand versus a forehand?
We want to make it more difficult for the returners to find our backhand, assuming that we don't like that wing, you know, quite as much. And our suggestion there is hug the far left as a right-handed player so that one of us gets a forehand and doesn't get stuck hitting a backhand, no matter what kind of return they hit.
But that's not necessarily all of the story, right? When we talk about forehands in the middle, you may be playing with someone who has a wicked two-hander and you might be at the net now doing a whole different, this might have a whole different dynamic, right?
Are you talking about now that we've gotten to the kitchen line?
Yeah, or in the transition zone or something. I mean, you've talked before about playing with Anna Bright or somebody that has just a lefty, obviously, that has just a wicked either two-hander or their forehands in the middle. So I don't know. I'm just curious about like the dynamic, if it is indeed splitting hairs between that stuff, or if that's something discussed ahead of time, like, man, your two-hander backhand is better than my forehand, or it's more accurate or more powerful or more, you know, whatever.
I think now that we've moved up closer to the net, the angle of where the shot comes from becomes super relevant to this conversation. Mm. So if the ball is coming from our opponent who's gotten pulled out wide on the odd side and they're hitting the ball cross court back to someone's forehand, it's going to go through the airspace of the player on the right first.
Right.
And
their backhand airspace.
Sure. And yeah, if they're right-handers, it's going to go through their airspace. It's going to bounce in front of them, or it's going to go through their airspace in the air. And I feel like it is a mistake to let that ball get to the forehand that's in the middle when you have the opportunity to cut that ball off, steal time from our opponents. And at 4-0 to pro, our backhand in the middle is pretty darn good. And it's no reason to just let it wait until it gets to the forehand. So I like to say, you know, from just a cardinal, you know, kind of principle here is if the ball comes through your airspace, you have first dibs.
There's something you said there too, I think that is maybe the most profound piece of this, which is stealing time from your opponent. I think that becomes paramount. I think that's probably the thing that is maybe the most important part of this discussion, is that if you start leaning towards ways or devising ways to get the ball back to your opponent before they expect it, that's going to obviously result in a higher winning percentage of the point. Something happened the other day. The ball kind of floated high. My teammate who was on the left-hand side didn't jump on it. So I did. And I just poked it right down the middle and put it between the two players and we won the point. And he was like, oh, that was a good take. But that was a great example of, I saw an opportunity where I could put it away with my backhand in the middle and the other team wasn't expecting it at all. They were definitely expecting my teammate to sort of hit a drive forehand.
Yeah, I guess if I could kind of go off script here a little bit and introduce another myth that's very similar to this, which is respect the X. These two go hand in hand. And you know, with respect to my friend Tony Roy, I think this is a valuable guideline, but I feel like once we're 4-0 to pro, that it gets outweighed by let's steal time from our opponents. Respecting the X in the scenario we're talking about is let's let that ball get to the forehand across the X from me because it's easier. The ball is coming at you, not going away from you. And I feel like that's important for a 3-0 player to choose the easier of the two balls. But what we're suggesting here at 4-0 to pro is that that's overridden by the stopwatch that's running, is we want to steal time. And that ball, in order to get to my partner who's across the X, it's got to go near my airspace. And I'm just suggesting that, like you did in that recent example, that you jump on that. You stick your paddle out. And even if it bounces, that you can get to it sooner than your partner who's on the other end of the X. And that's more important than which shot is easier.
I'm thinking about right now an example of where we might be in a dinking rally and the ball's going cross court. Where I've seen a mistake being made is that, let's say that I'm on the odd side or the ad side, if you're coming from tennis, and the ball's coming to me, and then my right side teammate just takes a stab with his backhand and drills it into the net or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas I had the opportunity to have a nice, relaxed dink and be able to place it with my forehand. I don't think we're talking about that, right? We're not talking about a stab. We're talking about a ball that you've got a high confidence level that you can do something with.
Did your partner in this scenario get it out of the air, whereas it would have bounced to you?
It did bounce. It was a bounce. I've seen it more on the bounce than not. where someone's taking a short hop backhand versus just letting it flow to the person who's fully cross court.
So two thoughts. If that partner with their backhand can snag it out of the air with their backhand versus it bouncing in front of you, I'm in favor of that.
Yeah, I'm in favor of that too.
I think you are as well. And as a good teammate, even if they hit it into the net, I would love it if you gave them a little pat on the back and said, "That's all right, dude, do it again." You know, that's the right play, even if it didn't work out.
But not after the bounce.
After the bounce, I think if you're on the left, and we've talked on this show before, you start this rally with a mindset of I'm going to be 20% more aggressive and 20% more verbal.
Yeah.
So you should read this situation and decide he's not going to get it out of the air. One of us is going to play this on the bounce, captain the team, and say, "I go. My ball." Yeah. Get that low backhand off the bounce out of there, and you come in and take it with your forehand. So, you know, are we busting myths here, or are we adding nuance to the discussion, adding tools to the toolbox? I think more the latter.
Yeah.
Because we're forward a pro, and we need extensive toolboxes, and nothing is black and white anymore. So these are good examples. Hopefully I made clear, like, I think if they can get it out of the air with their backhand, go for it, man.
Yeah.
But if it's going to bounce, then that player on the left, get in there and call it and take it.
Okay. So one and two are forehands in the middle and respect the X. We are dispelling those myths. The third one is interesting because we talk a lot about picking on the middle of your opponents. And there's communication issues. There's a lot of communication issues. But if you're able to get a ball down and in the middle, you're going to win more points. I think a lot of us, depending on who we're playing, maybe you're playing against a player that has a great drive and you really think, "Oh, I got to cover down the line." So they're really shifting over a foot or two from the outside line to the right or to the left. Well, what that's doing is they're sacrificing this 18 available inches of down the line shot to relinquish 4 feet of middle ball. And now you've got this huge hole in the middle of the court where you are most vulnerable as a team. So I almost want to dare them to go down the line.
Yeah, to me, this isn't necessarily, you know, clearly a myth buster, perhaps more of a misinterpretation of what coaches mean when they say cover down the line. I find a lot of players over-exaggerate their covering down the line and they move their feet, like you said, you know, a couple of feet over toward the line. And what I jokingly say is you're not only covering the line, you're covering 4 feet of out of bounds at this point. That's the big mistake. Because when they do that, you know, sure, they've got the line covered, but their opponents are just going to see that gaping hole down the middle. And that's not going to work out well. So it's a tiny court. It's only 20 feet. There's two of us. I say beware the line, you know, not necessarily have to move your feet over a whole bunch, but beware of the line. Know that that's your responsibility when that player right in front of you is threatening an attack. Just, you know, it's not going to take much of a move to cover that line. Let's not overdo it. Let's not overcover down the line.
Well, I'm a notorious non-earnier, and I should know how to do them. In fact, we should cover that on a show, is how to really learn an earnie. But I talked about a couple episodes ago about in my car racing days, how I would pace out these slaloms so I would know that I could go full speed, top throttle through a set of cones while I was racing my car. I wonder if there's something along the lines that we could do similarly here with this down the line, which is to hold your paddle out as far as it can go right on that line and then see where your feet are on the court and go, "All right, I literally never have to go to the right or the left of this because I can cover down the line standing right here." Does that make sense?
It makes sense on a stretch. Because I've done this. We're 5'8 on a good day.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, we can cover the line without necessarily even moving our feet.
We
just have to beware the line and not make the mistake of taking 3 steps over to cover the line. That's the myth.
It's nice to have a reference though, like a visual reference on this is as far as I really need to go on this court and I can still cover the middle. And if someone is laser accurate, which is so rare on a drive, if they have no margin and they're just going to paint the line, this is where this is going to go. You know, I think there's something to be said. We haven't done a whole show on misdirection yet, but we probably could on daring them to go down the line, like really playing middle hard and go, "Yeah, feel free to go down the line." And then right before before they hit it, you know, shift over to your comfortable down the line covering position and then watching the ball go out.
Yeah, especially if you're the player on the left, your job is middle. Your job is to crunch and threaten middle.
Yeah.
If you're my partner on the left, you're doing your job of really applying pressure in the middle and you get beat to your left down the line, I'm going to come over and say, no worries, man. You know, yeah. That make them hit that again.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very low margin of error shot and good for them if they make it every now and then.
You know, I've had occasions recently where we've lost points and I think I should have been more of a presence in the middle than I was on that point. Some of it is, you know, playing with new partners, you don't know each other very well. And so if they don't listen to this show, it's like you have to explain some of the rhythm and positioning to some people. But if they're down for it, when I play with somebody else, one of the first things I say is like, when you're on this side, I'm in cleanup mode. I am over here. I'm letting you take this much of the court. Like, feel free and really do it just like you did in that tournament. Was it Ryler you were playing with? He was like that. You said, I need to feel free to take as much as you want.
Sure. Yeah. I've done that a couple of times.
Yeah.
And maybe we've got a little bonus myth here as well is, you know, some people play as if there's a 10-foot bungee cord tied between the two of you and you move together with your partner.
Yeah.
I want slack in the bungee cord. If you're on the left and I'm on the right, I'm not over covering the line and you're allowing some slack in that bungee cord by hugging the middle. I don't want you right in the middle of the left box and me right in the middle of the right box. I want you hugging middle, pressuring middle. There's a little slack in that bungee cord and I'm not going to pull it taut to over cover down the line.
Right.
So let's keep that in mind.
Yeah, you can definitely see on the, certainly the pro level during a firefight, sometimes they're all standing literally right next to each other. Like they are very close. They're a foot away. They're 2 feet away instead of this equally balanced thing that happens. We talked a little bit about where to be when you're in full defense mode or whatever, but I think that's a full another show that we can do in terms of court coverage and how to position ourselves in, you know, situational pickleball, if that's such a thing. We should make it a thing.
Let's make it a thing.
Number four, myth number four. I'm still shocked by the level in which I see this, especially considering the demographic of the people that play this sport, is the complete like, hey, you don't really need to warm up because it's pickleball. And it's like, I don't know how many orthopedic surgeons have put that myth out into the world, but they are doing a great job with their campaign because we see people tearing ligaments and hammies all the time. I end up getting a ton of this side eye when I jump rope for a couple minutes before I play. And most people don't know that I've had 5 left knee surgeries. And if I don't do something, my knees hurt so much at the beginning that I'm useless until game 3 or something. So I don't want to be that guy. I'd rather walk in and have a good warm up. You and I, when I first trained with you a couple of years ago, we spent the first 10 minutes, you know, jogging around the court, doing side steps, you know, doing crossover, the things that you and I would have done playing tennis our whole lives. So I'm just surprised that people don't think you need to warm up. They go, well, dinking is warming up.
Well, dinking is warming up and you can make a decent sized warm up out of your dinking. But I'm into kind of functional movement before we get started. What kind of movement patterns are we going to need to play optimal pickleball on the court? So I like to warm the muscles up first, but then we really need to squat and lunge. And you know, it's funny when I present this to some of our newer players on the court and I say, why do we need to do that? And you know, I get some blank stares and I just take a ball out of my hand and I drop it and it bounces 9 inches off the ground.
Right.
And there's your answer. You know, because we play with a ball, it doesn't bounce much. So we need to be really effective at squatting, you know, biomechanically effective squatting and lunging. But I don't want to jump right into that. I mean, that's a decent way to get hurt in warmups. So we do need to move the body, warm the muscles a little bit, and then make sure we do some squatting and lunging. Now, we can do that in dinking if the primary goal is, you know, all we're going to do is gently move each other around while dinking. You move laterally. Let's get some side steps moving. Let's keep your shoulders level as you squat, you know, for the ball, you move sideways. You know, these are really important movement patterns you can do before dinking or as dinking. But unfortunately, too often we see people, they hit 4 dinks and then there's an attack and there's a counterattack and there's a lob. And, you know, that's where the injuries are going to come from without a functional proactive warm-up routine.
I see a lot of people pulling their paddles out of their bags. They dink for 45 seconds and someone goes, you ready? And you go, what? No. I'm not at all ready. And then there's this weird pickleball peer pressure to just start. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, you've got a guy who's limping off the court. So,
yeah. And injury prevention is a huge part of this, but also, you know, I don't want to get down 6-0, you know, before I figure out that I need to warm up some of the key shots. My favorite one, like you say, 45 seconds into dinking, they say, are you ready? It's like, we've been warming up for 5 minutes. And, you know, I'll occasionally be the one to say, hey, maybe we should hit a couple of cross court dinks on the off chance we do that during this game.
Right. You or know? Serve. I mean, how about a serve?
Right.
How about one serve or one return where the first return doesn't go 4 feet out?
Right. And I'm a big fan of a couple of kitchen games, you know, as part of warm up. Not only are they really beneficial, but they're fun. And at 4-0 to pro, a lot of these rallies are going to end up in the four-person ritual kitchen exchange. Why not play out a couple of kitchen games, little dingles or three balls cooperative, play the point out to win. Michael is sporting the four-person ritual kitchen exchange shirt to get into mood.
That's right.
To record
exactly
today.
Right. That's right.
So yeah, play some kitchen games, play games to five. I don't know if I mentioned it on this show, but another favorite kitchen game is the 5 mile an hour speed limit game. Mm. It's a great warm-up. We're going to have longer rallies. Nobody can hit it hard. You have to find a way to find some open space, catch them leaning the wrong way. These are going to be 20, 30, 40 shot rallies.
But what is it? What do you do?
We play, you know, we'll say three balls cooperative, three balls nice. Now we play the point out to win, but we institute a speed limit like on the pace of the shot. Mm. It's arbitrary, but you know, I'll be the judge when we play. And you know, I say 5 miles an hour, but really we're just not going to hit it hard. You have to find another crafty way to break them down and win the point with place over pace.
Oh, interesting.
Which is your next t-shirt.
Yeah, that's a good one. We have a rack of t-shirts coming. Myth number five is to rush to the net / stay even with your partner. You did allude to this stay even with your partner before, but this is like on a third when you're coming up to the net. The third hitter is watchful. And what did you say? Optimistic, but not, what was your?
Optimistic, yet realistic.
Yes, yet realistic. So you're going to hit your third, and instead of absolutely crashing to the net, you're going to see how it is first. And your partner, because they've watched you hit the third, and they have a really nice keen eye on what you're doing, might have a better angle on how it's going to affect your opponents. So if it's a great third, they can collapse on it probably quicker than you can as the hitter of the ball, which is ideal, right? Because you're then cutting off angles and looking for that ball that's going to pop up in which you can do something with. Correct?
Yeah. So we're talking about the serving side. We serve, they return, we're getting ready to hit a third. One player has to hit the third. The other player is the one who's optimistic yet realistic. And both players need to play a game of red light, green light. They need to assess the quality of the third, either step on the gas and go, or see the red light and stop, or more likely in a new school third world, look for a yellow hedge caution opportunity. But the non-hitter of the third, the striker in my world, can get a head start and should get a head start. But they also have to be realistic. And if it's not a green light, don't hustle forward. But if it is, they should probably beat the hitter of the third forward. And that's what breaks the myth, is you don't have to wait for the guy.
Yeah.
Move forward and move toward the middle and look for an opportunity to end the rally.
Yeah, a lot of times that other person, the person who's not hitting the third, I've seen them about mid-transition zone a lot, where they still feel like they can handle a high ball. And if they rip it back at them, they're ready. They've split step. They're in stable base, defensive mode, just in case. But if it's good, that means they're two steps away from being able to collapse on that and take the angle out and maybe do something with that pop-up.
One of my favorite scenarios for this shot is if I'm on the odd court, they've hit a deep return of serve to me. I'm a little bit on my back foot, but I love that inside out topspin looping third to the low backhand of the player diagonal from me. It's going to take me a little while to get to the net from this position, but boy, do I want my partner to jump on it, get in the face of the opponent who's diagonal from me, threaten Ernie, you know, at least just cause some pressure, put some pressure on them. We're going to get a pop-up or a missed dink. Nobody likes hitting that shot. It's even harder with someone, you know, just staring at you from 7.5 feet away. So
they only have one escape route from that scenario, which is a really well handled low cross court dink. That's the only way they're getting themselves out of trouble in that scenario.
Correct. Yeah, so, which is a tough shot and made even more difficult if there's pressure on you.
And we've been saying a lot of like, and this is maybe a little more on the receiving side, apropos of nothing. This is, has nothing to do with any of the myths. But what we've been doing lately is if you're that person who's already waiting at the net, so you're not actually receiving or returning the serve, if there's a high third in any way, I want you just take it. Take it wherever it is. Just poach it. I will go to the space that's vacated, wherever that happens to be. But if there's a high takeable, attackable third, go for it. Don't let it get to me if you could have put it away with one step. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I like to say that white service line completely disappears after the serve. There are right. No sides anymore. Player closest to the net has first dibs. It's only 20 feet of court. If you need to move to your right a couple of steps or to your left, do it.
Well, Scott, we said it all. That is five pickleball myths here on 4-0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast. Thanks, you guys, for listening. Thank you, Scott. I hear some clock, clock, clock of pickleballs behind you, so I know you need to go do things. And thanks for spending some time with us, bud.
Thank you. Thanks, listeners.
Folks, 402p.com/spinshot to get your own little spin shot ball machine. 402p.com/CRBN for 10% off your carbon paddle. And find us on Instagram at 4.0_2_pro. Thank you, guys. We will see you next time.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0 to Pro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.